Welcome to All Africa's Silence the Gun series, where we focus on peace building on the continent. This is Juanita Williams, and today we take a closer look at what the road to peace and peace building is for South Sudan, where the conflict officially ended in 2018. I'm speaking with Margaret Lewilla, Program Officer at the Women's International Peace Center in Juba. She shares the research she's done on women and peace building, as well as the impact that COVID-19 has had on the country's peace processes.
I was with the African Leadership Center in 2019. I was a fellow for 2019 to 2020. And then during that time, if you remember, actually that was around the time when COVID kind of broke out. It was good that the organization was able to, they had to re-strategize the program, right? So earlier we had gone to London and then come back, but we ended up having to do the final part of our program online because, you know, people were not traveling anymore. We couldn't go to the center anymore. Most of the things were shut down. I think in Nairobi, they shut everything down at the end of March, right? Yeah, so we were still at the end of our fellowship during that time. So most of our sessions were being taken online now. But we were also at the end. So it was a lot of us picking our topics that we wanted to do research on. So we did do research and we were allocated supervisors who kind of helped us and guided us through that process. During that time, the ALC also started an op-ed series on COVID-19 to kind of highlight the things that were happening around Africa and how, you know, COVID-19 was starting to impact some of the things. I contributed to that op-ed series, but I wanted to highlight the agency of South Sudanese youth and how they kind of came together and started responding within their neighborhoods. And then 2021, which is this year, I came to Juba in February. My ALC research paper was focusing on South Sudanese women's participation after independence, so from 2011. So I got the opportunity to actually work with the coalition. I volunteered there for about 3 months, which was lovely. It was a great experience to kind of have researched the work of the coalition and then now come and be a part of what they were doing. And then after that, I applied for this job. I was largely interested in it because it has a focus on women, peace and security. I've been with the Women's International Peace Center since June.
Oh, okay. So it's been a bit of a short time still. So you're still getting into the projects that you have there. But now I'm interested in your South Sudanese research project that you did with ALC before you left. Can you tell me a bit about that and, you know, why you chose it? Just take me through the whole process. I'd love to know about that.
So why I was definitely going to look at the South Sudan context and to kind of look at the dynamics of the peace process. A lot of the work of South Sudanese women participating is not very well documented, right? So no one has really, well, there are a few people, that's not true. There are a few people who have who have documented some of the work, but it hasn't been, you know, more needs to be done in that sector.
I think that's the case for the whole continent, actually. Some work has been done in some areas, but it really does need more attention.
For the South Sudan Women's Coalition and their participation in this last process, it was because so many women groups were able to come together under one sort of vision and use various, you know, platforms to get their message out and to get support, that they were able to kind of get some of the gains that they did in the peace process. So for example, getting the women's representation quota go up from 25% to 35%. Also in the peace process, they advocated for ensuring that the women who experienced sexual violence, that they would get justice. So there's a component in the peace process, chapter 5, that is focused on transitional justice and reconciliation, but it also focuses on getting justice for the women who went through sexual violence during that period, which was very, very important. So I was looking at my research paper. It's not published yet, but we're working on getting it published. It looks at how the coalition was able to influence the actors within the process. What are some of, you know, the tactics that they used, but also how they were able to sustain that influence over a long period of time.
And so what is, once the research paper is done, you say it's not been published yet, but then what is done with the research paper? What is the, what would you like to be the outcome? So now it's been written, it's waiting for publication. I know that obviously with most researchers, publication is the point so that, you know, other people have access to it. Is that the main aim?
I mean, yeah, it's important for people to have access to it, but I think there's so many lessons that could be learned from the some of the things that they did. The women's movement in South Sudan is still growing. I think documentation is important because it's a reference point, right? It's a reference point that we can look at and say, okay, what was done here? How did it work? What can we learn? How can we improve? It can be used by also, for example, a lot of young women coming into this peace building space, right? There's so many lessons that we can get and we can learn from here. So yeah, I guess that would be the point. For me, I think also it would be interesting to kind of have, because this is like the South Sudanese context, right? It would be interesting to kind of have this paper interact with other papers of, you know, other women coalitions or other women groups in other contexts in Africa, right? It would be interesting to kind of look at what are the similarities or what are the differences, but like, how can we build to make, you know, women's presence or women's influence in this, in peace processes, how can we make it more impactful?
And so as your, when your time at ALC came to an end, it was one year? You said it was 1 year.
Yeah.
What would you say is, at the end of your ALC fellowship, you know, what did you learn? What were your takeaways from that period with ALC? And, you know, going to Nairobi, because it also took you away from Juba. It took you to Nairobi, it took you to London. What was that like?
It was great. It was a very rich experience, right? It was a very rich experience. I got to meet and interact with a lot of great minds. It was great to be with other fellows from, you know, different parts of Africa and kind of, you know, interact and exchange ideas and learn from each other's contexts. One of the biggest takeaways, I guess, from the ALC fellowship is about like looking at the process of leadership. So, for example, in my paper, even when I was talking about South Sudanese women participation in peace processes, it was very important to define what, you know, peace processes were, because I think, you know, when you immediately think about that, you're looking at, oh, when they went to Addis and it was this very high level thing and, you know, the negotiation that went on there, which is a part of it and is very important, right? But then it's very, in order for the women to have the kind of influence that they did, it was a very multi-layered process. It was not just, some of us are going to Addis and this is what we're going to do. It was We're connected to the women constituency in South Sudan. What are the women in the communities talking about? What do they want? What do they need? And then having conversations also with young women, with the diaspora. So kind of connecting all these things to the larger process. So I think one of the things that I've taken away from the ALC is to not just look at, even when you're looking at a process, to be able to look at it in a very holistic, comprehensive way, where you're not just isolating just, you know, this one piece of it. There are many pieces of it that are working together. And at every stage, there's something, you know, to learn. It gives you a different perspective. Even when I was writing the op-ed on South Sudanese, you know, youth agency, a lot is said about South Sudanese youth. And, you know, a lot of it is related to violence. But there were very, very many groups who, you know, were out here trying to raise awareness on COVID-19. A lot of them put together, you know, like care packages for people. A lot of them were very innovative in, you know, creating these wash stations. Yeah. And that's not being highlighted, but it's happening. Mm. I think that's what it taught me, to kind of look at all these other processes and then bring attention to that, because all of that is also part of peace, right?
Yeah, and peace building. That is really interesting. And then those kind of small actions build into a bigger picture, as you said, you know, it really does. So what is your role at the Women's International Peace Center?
So I work at the Women's International Peace Center as a program officer. So what I do is I support the implementation of activities that are around women, peace and security. The center does a few things. We do capacity building. We build the technical capacity of, you know, women in peace building, women mediators as well, and also of young women to participate in political and peace processes. We also do knowledge production, so we do research. We currently carried out research on the impact of COVID-19 on women, peace and security in South Sudan. That is going to be launched in this month, I think on the 17th of November. We also launched, we did research on 20 years of implementing UNSCR 1325 in South Sudan as well. That was launched earlier this year. I think I can share a link with you. We have this component of where we do research, we do documentation of women's work in peace building, but we also do capacity building, and we try and amplify the advocacy work and efforts of women peace builders in the community.
How do you decide which projects to initiate or to follow through with on the Women's International Peace Center?
Okay, so as an organization, we have a strategic plan. So that is used to inform what kind of projects we're going to do. So basically, right now, we're focused on two main things, I would say. So we're trying to ensure the increased representation and influence of women in power spaces and institutions. So in South Sudan, for example, right now, there are several processes going on in terms of implementation of the peace process. We have started the, according to the RRCIS agreement in Chapter 6, we're supposed to start a permanent constitution-making process, which, yeah, so some of the steps have begun towards that. So we're trying to ensure that women can participate, whether in the constitutional making bodies or just have kind of like a technical body that supports the women who are in those bodies, but also in, you know, conducting advocacy or doing public consultations with, you know, the general public. And yeah, so that's what the organization focuses on. And then there's also supposed to be a transitional justice process, which has not fully begun yet, but you know, some of the things have started moving. So we pay attention to these processes that are happening both at national and state level, and then ensure that women are able to participate in these processes and have influence in these processes as well.
Okay, so when you say that you ensure that women are involved in those processes and they actually take part in it, how do you do that?
Okay, so as an institution, we do have, I guess, relationships and connections with other institutions or with, you know, some of the ministries. So in the background, we'll usually do, based on the processes that are happening, do like a mapping of stakeholders, who is where, how can we reach out to them, and then now ensure that the women we have either trained or some of the women organizations that we are affiliated with can come together and discuss, and then now see who is best positioned to be sent, you know, where, but also, who is best suited to be sent where, but to ensure just that we've done the mapping, we know, you know, who the stakeholders are, and then we figure out, you know, what is the best way to reach out to them and who is the best to reach out to them.
Oh, okay. Your organization's main focus is women in peacebuilding, but I'm nonetheless going to ask you what your thoughts are on the importance of women playing a role in peacebuilding and conflict resolution.
Women as members of the society have, you know, they have a stake in ensuring peace and in ensuring conflict resolution, right? A lot of conflict impacts, you know, women, young women, and girls in a very different way than it affects men. So it's important that they're there, because when conflict happens and it affects them in this way that a man does not necessarily understand, then they can provide solutions that also ensure that, you know, their needs and their concerns are taken care of. So for women to be involved is very important, because you can't leave them out of decisions that affect them. You can't leave them out of decisions that are used to dictate how, you know, the society is going to be or how their lives are going to be. They have to be able to participate in order for them to ensure that the systems and the structures that are in place are going to contribute to their well-being, right? Are going to contribute to their flourishing. That the atmosphere and the environment is in a way that they can flourish and that they can live well. So yeah, women have to be involved because they have a stake. They're members of the society and they have a stake in the society, and they have to participate in order to ensure that the kind of society that they live in is beneficial to them and allows them, you know, to live out their potential.
Yeah, so there's a lot of instances where women are just not part of decision making, and peace building is one of those. So what happens? So I just want to look at it from the other side. What happens when women are not involved in peace building processes? So that we can highlight some of the negativity that happens around excluding women, and for that matter, youth. You know, what would you say are the negative consequences of women not being involved in peace building?
That's a good question. So I think when women are not involved in peace building, okay, so first of all, when we're getting to peace building processes, it's because there was conflict or violence of some sort, right? And then you bring the warring factions together. And then what happens in those rooms when women are not there is that it becomes about power sharing and resources, and it's, you know, it's about you take this position, okay, you will control these resources, you take this piece of land, you Yeah, so it becomes about that, right? And then we lose the opportunity to do peace building in a way that, for example, takes into consideration other social aspects, like maybe, you know, education. I just spoke about justice as well for, you know, women who've endured sexual violence.
Yeah.
Again, if youth are not in the room, then you're missing the fact that youth largely lose out or do not have access to a lot of economic opportunities. Or, you know, when they try to engage or have their own innovative ideas, and they try to create opportunities for themselves, they're frustrated by, you know, in South Sudan, for example, we have the city council who's always just bringing fines. They're just fined for no reason. And there's no explanation. There's no accountability. You don't know where the money is going. It's just, do you know? So even when the government is not providing opportunities and you are creating opportunities for yourself, then you're being frustrated by, you know, these people or these systems. So yeah, when peace building does not involve or include women and youth, that's what happens. You miss out on all those other aspects that need to be included, because peace is not just, oh, we're not, you know, it's not just a ceasefire. There's, you know, although that is an important part of it, it's not just, you know.
How were women and girls affected by that process in South Sudan, you know, going from conflict to a place where, well, I suppose conflict, peace building, and to a place where there's assumption that, you know, things are kind of sorted out and there's stability? Yeah. How were they affected during the conflict? And then how are they still affected? And so moving from the conflict and them needing transitional justice, you know, what was the process there?
During the South Sudan conflict, women were affected because there was a lot of sexual violence. People's houses were burnt down. So a lot of, you know, women and children were displaced. It also just, of course, it just disrupts livelihood. You cannot be going, whether you had a farm or a shop or whatever you were doing, all those livelihood opportunities were completely put to a stop. Mm-hmm. A lot of, you know, because I guess during conflict, a lot of men will be killed or engaged in actual physical fighting, so will women, but then a lot of women were left, you know, without their husbands, without their sons. There was a lot of early and forced marriages, which is still happening till now. I don't know if you have seen, but now with social media and with technology, what happens is they literally post a picture of the girl on Facebook, and then people will bid, like actual bidding. Yes. And then, you know, whoever is the highest bidder, the girl is, I guess, sold off to the man. There's been a lot of, when this happens now, you know, young girls are now committing suicide or, you know, running away and we can't find them. It's heartbreaking. And it's young girls. They're 12, 13 children. So yeah, that's how women were impacted by the war, but they're still impacted now. I think there's relative stability in the city, in the capital city, Juba, but there's still pockets of violence that is still happening around South Sudan. And like I said, the issue of sexual violence, it continues. and young girls being forced into marriage, that has just, it's largely continued, and it's something that really needs to be addressed. But yeah.
Yeah, so I'm so sorry, and I'm also like I am cognizant of the fact that this conversation is triggering for you, because you've already done the research papers, and now you're having to repeat and it will bring up feelings, and I'm really like sort of trying to understand that. So just if you feel like, you know, there's something that you don't want to talk about, please tell me. Yeah.
Okay.
And I will respect that.
Yeah.
So the transitional justice process. So what are the expectations that are coming from having a process like that? Is it the same as, so South Africa had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The Gambia is busy with their TTRC at the moment. Would it be a similar process?
Yeah, I think they're supposed to set up a commission for truth, reconciliation, and healing. Yeah, where I think it's the same process where people are going to have to come and talk about the things that happened. There's also supposed to be a hybrid court that is going to be set up. So it's going to be a hybrid court because it's the African Union and the South Sudanese judicial system. Yeah. They're supposed to set up a hybrid court to try some of the perpetrators of sexual violence. And then there's also a component of reparations.
So that's when I speak about the South African experience, of course I lived through it, so I have knowledge of it. We did not have a legal process, a reparations process. We didn't have a process where people were actually prosecuted for what happened. And I think that's like, it's a really important part. I think after all of these years, people are like, well, apartheid was such a long time ago. But I think part of the reason that we don't feel like there has been justice is because there was none. As far as the legal process is concerned, there are still people walking around who were poisoning black people, who were creating medical, what do they call them? Biological weapons to test on people in South Africa. So that person is still a doctor in Cape Town.
Isn't that crazy?
I mean, absolutely.
It can be so infuriating when you know the people, like some of the people who've done some of these things, you know who they are, right? And then they still not only like are practicing in whatever profession they are, but like they're in like leadership positions. Like, what are we doing?
I know. It's like they're benefiting from the fact that they did these heinous acts. They're actually benefiting from them. So it was to their advantage, which is more than frustrating. And I can imagine it's the same in South Sudan as well.
Amnesty International wrote a report on I think it's transitional justice, I think, as well, in South Sudan. And the report, the title of the report, and this is a quote from someone they interviewed. Of course, they didn't say who it was, but the person said, "Will we prosecute ourselves?" And I was like, that's, listen.
The definition of shade, I don't even know if that's shade. It's so direct. Wow. Yeah, no, I mean, look, that's true. Like a lot of the cases, also with South Africa's government, there are people in the government that have done things that are probably never going to come out. And that's the thing. That's, you know, how do you peace build in a situation like that? I mean, it must be so hard. You're speaking about peace, yet There are people that are running through these scenarios in their head. They live these experiences, and we are trying to, peace builders, researchers are trying to work to a point where people are not necessarily going to embrace what happened, but move on from it. So, you know, that this, and there are certain steps that you need to go through. And so, you know, if you don't fulfill all of those, like, I think that the Gambia situation right now, it's already being said that it's not enough. That it's not enough. And when you have been attacked in that way, when you have been discriminated against, when you have been beaten, when you have been, you know, all of those things, it's traumatizing, firstly, but moving on from it is not something that you even consider when the people that caused it. How do you move towards peace when they haven't acknowledged?
Yeah.
And that's the thing. So, okay, let's start with, how do you move on from it if there's no acknowledgement of what happened? I mean, it makes a peace builder's work really difficult.
Yes. Yes, it does. There's a group, there's a coalition group that tried to call people to action, to protest. And no one really, they didn't get that much support. And the reason why is there is so much trauma in this country. And when they had announced, the government just started, there were like big tanks and like, they were showing that they are in charge. There was like big tanks just like around the neighborhoods, just driving, and there was such a heavy like security presence on the road. Like, people were scared. And I was like, there's so much trauma. The conflict just ended in 2018. No one wants to go through any of that again at all. But you're right. When there is completely no acknowledgement of what has happened, the impact that it's had, it's difficult. Even the way we talk about peace processes, the way we do peace processes, it just, to me, it's a bit flawed, right? If it's the people who have used violence are the ones that are being brought to discuss how they're going to now, you know, come and build or rebuild peace, it's a bit,
you're right, it's a flawed process if it doesn't take into account the trauma that has happened and the post-traumatic stress that all of the people in South Sudan must be feeling, because South Africa's conflict was ages ago. At least people, you know, it was ages ago. Notwithstanding the fact that we are still in that process of trying to build, you know, peace. It's an ongoing process. But for me, when I see a tank like the ones that were chasing the school children when I was at school, that were firing at the school children, if I see a tank like that now, I still, my stomach sinks to the bottom. My reaction is one of panic.
And
there's a good 30 years between who I was then and who I am now, and it's still present for me. So, and I mean, I was chased, and I was beaten once. There are people that spend time in jail that were tortured, you know, and so, and their families were killed, and they ended up in prison. And as you said, they were raped by police, they were raped by officers. The trauma that leaves behind is something that peace building, I don't want to say it doesn't quite cover it, because it does try to, and especially with organizations like yours, where it's actually, you know, the focus is that women, you know, like what women experience during the conflict. And that does need to be dealt with, and the training that you are doing, the projects that you do actually try to deal with that. But because we are women, we tend to, and it's a stereotype, but emotions are something that we know, we understand, and we know that it's going to stay in your body, in your psyche for a while. But what about the men? They were the perpetrators. Some of them were victims, survivors of violence as well, survivors of sexual violence. But no one is trying to bring those men, like you said, they come to the meetings. They're the perpetrators, mm-hmm. and they come to the meetings speaking about peace building when they haven't acknowledged their own part in the conflict. You know what?
Yeah.
So, okay. I don't know if I don't have a question, actually, because what do I ask you? Do I ask you? So what do we do in that situation? You know, what is the step? What is the missing step in the peace building process? That is a hell of a question.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah.
When you just spoke about the men and what happens to them as well. I've been in a training with community-based peace mediators, and I guess we were just having conversations and stories. And, you know, they'll tell you about, you know, and this is not like based on their work. This is not just like their lives of like, oh, they, you know, I had an uncle who was, you know, a soldier. And then, you know, something happens and you don't know that, you know, they're gone. And like, so, you know, the women, this was the story. The women are in the, you know, refugee camps. Again, this is something that's not talked about, but they're the ones who we'll do small business, and then you'll get a message that, you know, your husband doesn't have this. So you do small business, you send money for him, or you send him clothes, or you, again, I feel like why doesn't this get talked about? But yeah, and then he comes back, and, you know, sometimes because of the experience during the war, they come back disabled or whatever, but they come back and they... Because also the roles have changed, the woman now is empowered, getting money. He's violent. He's drunk all the time. He's frustrated. Of course, it's not just as simple as he's just a drunkard and he hits his wife.
Exactly.
You know, it's layered.
Yes.
You know, he experienced something that is completely wild. He's come back to a completely different reality as well. Things have changed in his household. He might not, let's say society is telling him, you are the head of the household, you are the leader. He might not even know how to do that anymore in this new, different reality. Mm-hmm. There's no support necessarily for him to talk about what has happened. The only thing he's known is just using his gun to get what he wants. So he doesn't know how to do anything else. This is all he knows how to do. It's a lot.
Yeah.
And this needs to be addressed. There are a few organizations, because we, part of what we do as an organization, we also focus on healing and wellness, right? But, you know, more organizations, I think, now are looking at trauma healing. And just trying to fit that into the whole, you know, peace building conversation, that we have to do trauma healing, we have to provide support for these people. Like, the conflict has left so much, you know, behind. It just, again, the guns stopped, and then, like, you can't just expect us to just now go back. So much damage has happened. So a lot of things have to be done to, you know, to address that.
Yeah, and then, of course, we also, within the space of a year, you say there was still fighting, and there still is fighting going on in some pockets, but 2018 is when the, you know, the official sort of end. And then a year later, the pandemic happened.
COVID.
And then now on, so now for women, basically, it's dealing with men that have come back, it's dealing with sons that have come back, and then some girls that have come back because they ended up with the military somehow, and ended up in different positions in the military, and what I'm speaking about, and so they've come back home, and now you have to deal with that trauma, with trying to live like a normal life, but their normal life is upended by COVID, and then peace building has to be pulled in so many different directions because you have to deal with, but it still all comes down to the women and how they handle it, because yes, men are seen as the head of the household, but in their absence, that has changed, like you said. So so that is where Women's International Peace Centers, the COVID and Women's Project, the COVID and how it's affected peace building, or how it's affected South Sudan, comes in. And I just want to, speak a little bit about that. We don't have that much time left. But so the COVID project has come out already.
We finished it. It's going to be launched on the 17th, on the 17th of November.
Oh, okay. So is there anything you can tell me about that?
Yeah, I think I can share a bit. So, the COVID-19 had an impact on South Sudan in general, on peace and security. It was, mostly in terms of how it slowed down the process of implementation. So because COVID has come now, they had to refocus, to COVID response. But even refocusing to COVID response was, a lot of violence still came with that, in terms of the military being used to enforce COVID restrictions. And then also because the borders were shut down, a lot of food coming in to Juba comes from outside. So comes from Uganda, comes from Kenya. So there was a period of time where, there was like scarcity of food. And that's now, when you think about that and relate it to the military enforcing, COVID-19 restrictions, they also had limited access to food. So it was not a great situation in terms of that. There was an increase in crime.
Was the increase in crime related to the fact that there was scarcity?
Yes.
Was crime about food?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Like someone would actually come and break into your house. And so I think, someone told me that, something like that, like come and eat your food or like steal your food.
Wow.
Which is heartbreaking.
It is. Wow.
So yes, there was that. There was again an increase in early enforced marriages because of, poverty, when you don't have, and then someone comes and presents money to you or gifts or also an increase in sexual violence because, people were trapped in the house with
the abuser.
So that's some of what came out of that.
What would you say the situation is now in South Sudan? Like a couple of minutes of like, so what's it like now? What is it like living in Juba? Because I mean, Juba is also like a little bit of an exception because it's a big, big city. And so of course the rural areas are going to be different, but what is it like living in South Sudan right now?
Well, in Juba right now, there hasn't been, the violence that's happening is at the state level. So it's not happening in the capital city. In terms of COVID, I don't know. I don't have the facts about this because I don't know if we haven't reported as high numbers as, I guess, other people, I would say that. So I don't know if that's because people are not being tested. therefore we do we actually do not have any accurate information about that, or we just have not registered that many cases. I'm not sure. But yeah, people are going to the office and they're working from the office. We try to, you know, still use hand sanitizers and use our masks.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I can say in terms of COVID.
Okay.
But some vaccinations have come in and people have started getting vaccinated. And yeah, I think there was information passed on by the National Task Force on COVID-19, just to encourage people to go and get vaccinated.
Okay. And the you say COVID has slowed down the peace process as well, while organizations like yours are involved in training and in capacity building so that women can move up to, you know, that kind of decision-making level. So where is the process right now?
A lot has been done in terms of forming the transitional government. The main thing that has been lagging and is critical to this peace process is Chapter 2, which is the unification of the armed forces. They were supposed to be trained and they were supposed to go through professionalization. And then they were supposed to be, you know, united into one unified force and graduated. So that is lagging. That is lagging behind a lot. It has been reported, you know, that in some of the cantonment sites that they were supposed to be, there was, you know, there was no food, there was no medicine, there was a lot of things that were lacking, and therefore they just left. The soldiers just left. Yeah. So a lot of the cantonment sites were abandoned. So I'm not sure what is being done right now to ensure that this process continues and gets done, but it is the main component that's lagging behind.
So, but is there anything else that's coming up that the center is working on?
Yeah, we're also planning to have an annual peace convening. So we're going to bring together stakeholders from, you know, from the government, from civil society, to just come. And I think for this one, we're going to focus on women's participation in the permanent constitution making process. That's coming up. And I think it's coming up around the same time we're going to have the launch of the impact of COVID-19. And then right now we're also working with community-based peace mediators so that we're not just focused in Juba, we're in Bor, we're in Mundri, and we're in Ye as well. So we're kind of just focusing on the rising issues within those specific contexts and trying to ensure that the peace mediators that are there are able to engage in conflict resolution in their specific context.
Margaret, thank you so much. This has been an awesome conversation. Is there anything else you'd like to say? Anything you want to end off?
In one of your questions, you had said it was about women and youth participation in decision making. Yeah. I just wanted to highlight, just because I work with young women and, you know, I'm a young woman myself, that, you know, sometimes it's more difficult for us because we do face, you know, double discrimination of gender and being young. But we are participating. Young women are in this space, and we try to do our best to participate. And I just hope that as I continue to be in this space, that I encourage just more young people in general to add their voice. I think, you know, sometimes this space can be intimidating. When you think about peace process or peace building, sometimes you're like, no, that's for other people. But no, it's the decisions that are made in these spaces affect you directly, and you do have a stake, right? And if you can contribute towards making your own life better, the lives of people around you, then I encourage young people to be active, and to be active in their own way. If you're artistic, use your art. If you're a singer, sing. but we all have something that we can contribute and bring to this space. So I encourage young people to get involved.
Thank you so much. It was great speaking with you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the All Africa Silence the Gun series on peace building in Africa. You were listening to Margaret Lawala, a peace building researcher and program officer at the Women's International Peace Center in Juba, South Sudan. Thank you once again for sharing your expertise with us, Margaret. All Africa is grateful to the Carnegie Corporation of New York for supporting our reporting on peace building in Africa.